Hello, friends. Welcome back. I have been getting a few emails with some questions that are really worth talking about, but they are not specifically about Mark so much. So I'm going to put them into this podcast, this episode. And if you don't care and don't want to know, then you do not have to listen. I thought I would probably put it, earmark it differently. So it'll be separate from the other podcasts. So we can go into Mark. We're going to continue with our Mark study in the following episode, but you do not have to listen to this one if you do not want to. And I also want to put in a little bit of extra detail. I talk about it a lot and repeated myself a lot, but I did realize that perhaps if anybody is interested in some of the Bible references, the Sons of God references, I would show my working a little bit. And again, I'll just put that here, so that you don't have to have this in the Mark study, because it's not directly about Mark, but it is all background material. I'll just first do this about Sons of God. In terms of secondary literature, I strongly recommend, there's a man named Michael Heiser, and his book, The Unseen Realm. He's written some popular level books. The Unseen Realm is a much more scholarly study. He's an Old Testament scholar who pays attention to a lot of this stuff. It's fun. The way I enjoy going into Mark, and I deliberately choose the most thorny passages, and then I enjoy talking about them. Well, he does the same with the Hebrew scriptures. He's a Christian, Pentecostal, charismatic Christian who is also highly biblically educated in the Old Testament, and he's a scholar. And I'll be honest that those two don't often coincide, and that's valuable to get. I'm not trying to be mean, but anybody who's spent time in some of these circles, of which I am one of them, I am part of that world. Genuine, intellectually rigorous scholarship doesn't often happen also in charismatic Pentecostal world, especially people who love talking about spirits and spiritual warfare and demons and angels and things. And so to find somebody like a Michael Heiser is gold dust. And I really recommend his The Unseen Realm. It's a credible book, and it's about a lot of the most thorny, strange, odd passages in the Hebrew scriptures. Well, in fact, the whole Bible, because he then goes into the New Testament. But Heiser is so good at describing and unpacking some of this language, this sons of God, demons, angels, Satan type language that one finds. And I've been summing it up here and there, and it's hard to sum up because it's a worldview that it underlies a lot, and we've just forgotten a lot. And then you often teach on this to believers or to people who've been Christians their whole lives, and they say, "How come I've never heard any of this before? And how come nobody talks about it if it's so important?" And the best example I can give is that it's a bit like I don't begin every lecture, I don't spend every 5 minutes of every podcast saying, "All right, so the world is round, and the earth revolves around the sun. Okay, now that we've established the basics, let's talk about the Gospel of Mark." It's a bit like that with sons of God and angels and demons. It's part of the worldview, it's part of the intellectual imagination building blocks or furniture of the scriptures. And they don't pause and unpack it every time. So the Apostle Paul, for example, is constantly referring to this kind of stuff. The New Testament is always drawing from it. The book of Revelation is drawing from it. The Gospel of Mark is alluding to it. And I don't pause and just say, "Okay, everyone, the world is round and it revolves around the sun. Okay, now let's talk about Jesus." It's just a given. And some of this Sons of God language, which is in the Greek Orthodox Church, the theology is of divinization. And a lot of evangelicals and Protestants get nervous about this, but it really is a deeply historically Christian idea. And it's not divinization in that you are God, Yahweh, you are the Most High. It's more God became a human so that humans might become gods, or might access the divine, or take their rightful place in the authority over the world. And this is the story in the New Testament. And I know it sounds odd to Protestant or evangelical ears, but that's on us. This is a historically valid and scripturally rich idea. And it is not that you are God and that in looking deep inside yourself and you get to uncover the secrets of the world through your own heart and head. It's not, I'm not saying that, but we're saying that you will judge angels. We are saying that all creation waits in eager expectation for the sons of God to be revealed. We're saying that when the church endures through the sufferings of this age, Jesus will say, I give you the morning star. Come sit at my throne. Share my rule. It's what happens when he gives his disciples authority to cast out demons and to heal the sick. And they come back and he says, I saw Satan fall like lightning. This is God becoming a human so that humans might live as God. I don't know how else to say it, and I know that sounds weird, but bear with me. Let's look at some of the key verses here, and I'll rattle them off. I really do think you should just go have a look at Michael Heiser. Throw some money that guy's way and get his book on Kindle, frankly. But here we go. Here's some of it. So Genesis 1:26, where God says, let us create in our image. And there's we language, and it's plural. It's famously plural, and a lot of Christians will immediately think, oh, that's the Trinity. But it's not the Trinity. It's the plural language for the Godhead, which is Elohim. And Elohim is not a name of God. It's a genre. It's a type of which God, the Yahweh, is the Most High. But there are other Elohim in the Old Testament. And Yahweh is the head of them all. Much like the queen or the prime minister is a human being, but they are in charge of other human beings. So the general term is human being, and the status and the hierarchy is a different way of describing them. So the queen, her name is not human being. Her name is Elizabeth, and she is the queen over other humans. I don't know if that makes sense, but anyway. So there's we language. God is described as a member of a community. And he makes humans and lifts them up into this relationship. And the words that the Old Testament uses to describe this is that the Elohim are part of the divine council, or the hosts, the council of hosts. And so, for example, like Psalm 82 is quite clear on this, Psalm 89, where the Lord Most High gathers together the other sons of God, or Elohim, and sometimes they're called angels, sometimes they're called demons. They're spiritual beings. When they're good, they're angels, usually, and when they're bad, they're demons. But anyway, he calls together the sons of God, and he gathers them in his council. In Psalm 82, Psalm 89, and as I said before, the story of this Elohim ruling council is basically that they're doing a bad job. And the Lord Most High says to them, You have the rule of the nations, but you are not doing what I want you to do. There's still injustice in the land, the poor are being oppressed, that kind of thing. Another example of Elohim, or sons of God, doing a bad thing would be Genesis 6, 1 to 4, the famous Nephilim, which are the sons of God that are attracted to the daughters of men, to humans, and they come down and they mate with them, and their children or their offspring become giants, or known as giants in the land. And it's this event in Genesis 6 that immediately precedes the flood. So this is the event that seems to be evil is now inextricably intertwined into the world. The place where the Nephilim are historic or mythically, legendarily said to have landed on Earth, the Hebrews sometimes called the sons of God stars. They looked up into the sky and they saw them like stars. So the stars are up in the sky and they look down and they see the daughters of men, and so they come down And where they touched was the plains of Shinar. This is one of the plains places they're supposed to have touched down. Well, the plains of Shinar is where the Tower of Babel was built. And the Tower of Babel in Genesis 11 is, of course, also the beginning of the city of Babylon. So you're starting to see that the Babylonians linked the beginning of their civilization to their relationship to the sons of God. So building the tower was to reach back up to the skies, to be as gods again. So this is what they're doing. Our ancestors came down from the stars, and now we're going to go back up. And then, of course, what happens is that in their arrogance, they are struck down with lots of different languages and chaos and confusion. Pay attention to the sons of God language here. The Nephilim show up again in Numbers 13, 32 to 33, in Deuteronomy 32, and then 8 and 9, and also 32, verse 17. You're getting again the clear correlation between sons of God and nations, or their rule over different people groups. And again, it's not a positive thing. They seem to have rebelled in some way. Job, one of the oldest books in the entire Old Testament, Job 1 and 2 has mention of the council, the divine council God calls together, the divine council, the semi-divine beings that are under him, and he calls them together. And they're called the sons of God. Job 1:6, Job 2:1, they're explicitly called sons of God, this council. And Satan is one of them. He makes an appearance. I think, I'm not going to die on this hill, but I think this might be one of the first appearances of Satan historically, if Job is one of the oldest texts. And Satan is a son of God. He's part of this divine council. And interestingly, if all you had was Job, it's not even apparent that Satan is necessarily a bad guy. It could be that he's just doing his job. His job is to test, or to bring people to the Most High in order to test their quality. It could be that. And this is part of the development, which I think I'm outside of my wheelhouse here. I like talking about it, but I'm not an expert. I'm not an expert in any of this, I hope you know. I'm just an educated hobbyist. But in any case, I would hasten to add that I love it and I teach it, but I am standing on the shoulders of other people that have done this work. I would really like to point that out. But if you're interested in Satan, there is a basic story, which is that the figure of Satan develops. So, for example, in Genesis, the snake who tempts Eve, the snake is described as he's a sort of a fantastic creature. Michael Heiser argues, he says he is one of the sons of God. The sons of God often show up as fantastical beasts. Eagles with lions' heads and that kind of thing. And here it's a talking snake who even seems to have legs at one point. And again, the point is that the snake is this glittering creature who's living with other sons of God in the Garden of Eden, and then is jealous of the other humans who have been brought into this fold as fellow sons of God. And so the snake sows dissension. But it is just worth pointing out that at no time is the snake called Satan. Satan becomes identified with the snake in the New Testament later on. And because there's this developing idea of who Satan might be. And there are some passages, for example, in 2 Samuel 24. If Job is the earliest text, then Job might be the earliest. But in any case, in terms of actually reading the Bible, the first time the word Satan shows up, first of all, have a look at 2 Samuel 24. So we get this story where King David, he sins. And he sins because he's numbering Israel. Like he doesn't trust God, and he sort of goes against his what he should be doing. And he takes it into his own hands, and he counts up all the people he's got. And this incident is recorded in 2 Samuel 24:1, all right? And in this earlier entry, David's sin is said to have been related to the anger of God, or God's wrath. But then the same story is told, and it was written down a few centuries later in 1 Chronicles 21:1. So we have what happens is the Chronicles and the Samuel stories, they overlap, or they tell the same events, but from there's a different points of view and also a different time span between them. And they're both in our Old Testament scriptures. They're both part of the people of God and their story. And in 1 Chronicles 21:1, this same story is recounted, but this time Satan is said to be the cause of David's sin. So Satan shows up. In the first story, the older story, it's the wrath of God or the anger of God. And in the second story, it's Satan who does it. And this is part of this idea that there is a developing idea of who Satan might be. And I know that it's complicated and I know that it's awkward and it doesn't all tie up into a neat little bow, but I don't know what else to tell you. This is the Bible we have. This is the scriptures we have. That Hebrew scholars, and even still today, a lot of Jewish teaching will sometimes refer to Satan as God's angry voice, or the left hand of God, or the angry part of God. And there isn't really a differentiation. It's just that Satan is part of the divine manifestation. And that when Satan shows up, that's God's wrath. But Christian thought has taken a different turn, where that development that one is seeing in the Hebrew scriptures of Satan, who begins life as one of God's Elohim, one of God's right hand co-rulers or underlings, Satan develops a character of his own, which he is proud, and which he is deceitful, of which he is jealous. And this is where that if Satan becomes linked with the snake. And so people, it's within Jewish tradition, but also later Christian tradition, they'll say, where we saw the Son of God in the garden, who is jealous of humans, that seems to be what Satan is doing in Job. And that seems to be what's happening to Satan in other areas, which I'll talk about in a second. And so then you can find the fact that the wrath of God is attributed to David's sin in one book, and then centuries later, the next book telling the same story attributes this to Satan. And we're starting to get permission to see that not every evil thing that happens is because directly of God, that there is another agent at work, or there is something else going on, a willful pride, a willful arrogance, which is tempting people away from the rule of God. And it's part of the cosmos. And this is all related even to the philosophical question of the problem of evil and of free will. And if God is so good, why does evil exist? And I mean, it's intractable. It's a fully complicated question. But the Christian, one of the Christian answers to this question, and I'll admit that it doesn't solve all our problems, is that the evil that's in the world is not because God directly willed it. It's because in order to have a free choice, to freely choose yes, freely choosing no is also an option. It's a real option, and it's not a fake one. Because choosing yes is so good that to say yes to God has to be a real choice, because God didn't make robots. And this choice seems to have been, freedom is baked into the beginning of creation. And so the choice is not just humans, it's also all creatures. All creatures like Elohim, who have emanated from God, are also given this choice. And what happens in the mysterious stories of the Hebrew scriptures is that not all Elohim choose to remain in the place to which they've been created. And this is, Satan becomes one of the arch examples of this, but he's not the only one, but he's the arch example. Have a look at Isaiah 14, 12 to 15. And whereas there's a character, the Luciferian character called the Day Star, or the Morning Star, the brightest star in the sky, is struck down because of his rebellion. The same character shows up in Ezekiel 28, 11 to 19, and here he's called the King of Tyre. And again, because the spiritual beings are given rule over nations, these sons of God they're the same to think of a son of God is also to think of a character in some way with rule and reign. And here he's called the King of Tyre, who is an actual king of an actual place, but also this referring to his spiritual being that is part of his role. An Elohim character who's assigned to Tyre, and he's called the King of Tyre, just as is a real man. And the King of Tyre is cast down. He's described in Ezekiel 28 as being like an angel, but then he's struck down. And it's Ezekiel 28 that Jesus is quoting when he says, "I saw Satan fall like lightning." Think of what a falling star looks like. This idea that Satan is this, he becomes associated with the King of Tyre, becomes associated with the morning star. He becomes associated with the serpent. And one of the things that's always happening is the serpent is struck down to the ground. The King of Tyre is struck down to the ground. The day star is struck down. Satan is always falling. It's one of the things Satan does. And then he's going to do it in the Gospels, and he's going to do it in the book of Revelation. One of the things about Satan is he's always puffing himself up, and he's always being struck back down. And then you have Daniel 7, another key verse where this is, I've talked about this before, but this is where one like a son of man, it comes and sits at the throne and is given dominion over everything. And the son of man is given dominion over the areas that the sons of God should have been given dominion over. So this is just some of the key verses here, but it's all forming the imaginative backdrop of the New Testament. I mean, it's worth pointing out that in Roman culture, sons of God was a term they used for their Caesars and their kings and their rulers, because the more powerful a little ruler, the more powerful a ruler you were, the more of a little god you were. So it's a very similar idea, actually, that rule and divinity are connected. And being called a son of God, you know, is a good thing for the Romans. And we'll come across that in the Gospel of Mark. In the New Testament, I mean, there's a lot of... So Jesus identifies with the Son of Man, who himself has a relationship to sons of God, being given dominion. Jesus, when he gives authority, Matthew 16 and Matthew 18, he gives authority to Peter and to the church. And he's giving authority about whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven. Whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven. Again, there's a divine authority to do with ruling and reigning. And specifically in Matthew 18, by the way, it has to do with conflict resolution. If you go look at that. So it's about managing how we organize ourselves. In John 10, 34 to 35, the Hebrews come to Jesus. They're angry at him. The Jews they accuse him of blasphemy because he's likening himself to a god. And in John 10, 34, Jesus quotes Psalm 82. "Even your own scriptures say you are gods." And he goes back and he quotes that very psalm, which is about sons of God doing a bad job and then new ones being lifted up in their place. Romans 8, I already quoted that all creation waits in eager expectation for the sons of God to be revealed. That's Romans 8, 18 to 24. 1 Corinthians is filled with it. There's lots of evidence where he talks about people being keys, given keys to the kingdom, or being wise like God, or having the wisdom of God. And he's attributing this to believers. He says, you know, in 1 Corinthians 11, he says, women, cover your hair in worship because of the angels. And this was possibly an allusion to the Nephilim. If the old story is that the angels are looking down on humans and seeing the humans as the daughters of men, as an object of lust and affection, well, he then says, all right, humans, you are no longer the object of attraction for angels. It's the other way around. You're above them now, looking down on them. That's why you should cover your hair. It's awkward and weird, but I think that might be part of it. There's also, 1 Corinthians 6. Hey, believers, don't take each other to court. Don't you know that one day you will judge angels? Philippians 2:15, he says, "You, to the believers, you shine like stars in the universe." Hebrews 1 and 2 have lots of this language about Jesus being superior to the angels. And then we are lifted up and reigning with him. I don't know, many sons are brought to glory. children share with Jesus in Hebrews 1 and 2. It's quite a lot of that. Go and have a read Hebrews 1 and 2, which is the vision of what Jesus is doing when he reigns, and then pay attention to how much of this is about sons of God being raised up with him. In 2 Peter 1, 3 to 4, we're sharing in the divine nature of Jesus. Revelations 2, 26 to 28, this is where you get the church or the ecclesia that is given authority over the nations. The church is given authority over nations. Remember, sons of God had the authority over nations. And now in Revelation 2, the church is given authority over nations. And they're given the rod to rule the nations. Now, I've been in a room with a famous celebrity charismatic preacher whose name most of you will have heard of, and I won't say his name. But I've been in a room with him having a discussion directly one-to-one with this guy when I was talking. I'm quite critical of patriotism and nationalism, as some of you will know. And we were talking about the vision for nations in the Bible. And this guy is an American charismatic preacher. He's very big on the idea that nations are important and are affirmed in the scriptures. And he said, yeah, look, see, the church is given the rule of the nations, the rod to rule the nations. Well, yeah, in Revelations 2, the church is given the rod to rule the nations in the very same verse. We're not, it's the same sentence. We're not even talking about another chapter. In the very next line is the church is given the rod to smash the nations. This is what the church does. It dissolves the nations. The book of Revelation is not a rubber stamp affirmation of nations and their individual claim to sovereignty. The vision of the nations in the book of Revelation is that all the rulers who are quasi-spiritual beings will take their crowns and throw them at the foot of the cross. They throw them at Jesus' feet. The dissolution of the nations is their salvation. The healing of the nations at the end of Revelation is in some ways when they give up their claim to sovereignty and absolute atomistic semi-divine rule, their arrogance. So the church is given authority over nations, it's given the rod or the scepter, and then it smashes them, and they're given the morning star. To you I give the morning star. The old rule that's supposed to belong to Satan, who is of course described by Jesus as the prince of the age. And of course it's Satan who says to Jesus, if you bow to me, I'll give you all these nations. So Satan in the New Testament is always associated with ruling and reigning of the nations. And he's also associated with this idea of the morning star. And here Jesus says to the church, I'm going to give you authority over the nations. And then I'm going to give you the morning star. He who has an ear, let him hear. Revelations 3:21. To the one who conquers, to he who overcomes, to the church that endures, I will give you the throne. This is just some half an hour worth of this. And I think that maybe this is a good place to stop here. And then we will go back in and look at some of the questions and some of the Bible stuff in a following podcast. But I'm going to stop here. Sons of God, look up Michael Heiser and see what you think.